You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey everybody, welcome to Literary Disco on Lit Hub Radio, episode 157, Pale Fire. On today's episode, we discuss Vladimir Nabokov's 1962 novel Pale Fire. Less popular than his book Lolita, Pale Fire is nonetheless complicated, maintains a rabid fan base, and has received a wide variety of interpretations. This is Literary Disco, the last book club you'll ever need. We are Todd, Julia, and Ryder, three old friends who love to read, debate, and sometimes even agree. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, are novelist and critic Todd Goldberg and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel. Hey, guys.
Hey! Welcome. Hey, it's an exciting time here on Literary Disco because as we're recording this episode, I'm also watching the National Book Awards to see if my friend Layla Lalami wins the National Book Awards. So if while we're talking, I begin to scream, it's because my friend has won the National Book Award.
So how are you trying? Are they televised? Like, I don't know the National Book Award. The ceremony streaming live?
They screen it live on Facebook and on their website. And I guess maybe presumably on YouTube or something. I'm watching it on Facebook right now. And according to the number of eyes watching it, are you ready?
Yeah.
560.
Wow. Huge. That's like an average download session of our episode. One of our episodes.
That's, you know? Not. That's like, it's like one. Yeah, we do more. 1/20th.
That's a little sad, actually.
It's very small comparatively.
So wait a minute. Where do the National Book Awards like occur?
They give them out in New York. Where the National Book Foundation is based. National Book Foundation, the executive director is a wonderful woman named Lisa Lucas. She always comes out to the LA Times Festival of Books and is on a panel. So if you live in Southern California and you're used to going out to LatFob to see me and Ryder, next time also see Lisa Lucas. She's really a huge champion of the arts, and they put on an amazing book award show. Subsequent to her becoming the executive director, they have started airing it. It used to show up on like PBS 2 months after the event. Steve Martin would host it and it would just show up, and like it seemed like it was always in the basement of the Waldorf or something. I don't know where it's going on now, but it looks pretty and people are in black tie and there's a poet with weird hair talking now about, I presume, books of poetry, something like that. But this is the second time that I've been watching the National Book Awards while doing something else when a friend of mine has been up for it. The last time I was watching it, well, I was hosting a movie screening at UCR, and my friend Robin Benway won the National Book Award for her amazing, the most amazing, most heartbreaking, I've never cried so hard in a book, written by a friend of mine's book, Far from the Tree, which won for the best YA novel. Oh, God, I love that book. Anyway, she won that year in 2018. Or 2017, rather. And I burst into tears at UCR. It was embarrassing.
That sounds nice.
Yes. So if I burst into tears here now, just be like, oh, it's like when Todd and Ryder read that poem about being men.
Todd, did I ever tell you about my association with the Edgar Awards?
No.
Yeah. I'm just realizing while I listen to you talk, I probably never told you about this. But when I lived in New York, my girlfriend at the time was a writer, and so as a day job she became like the right hand woman to the woman who ran
to Marjorie
the Edgar Awards. Is that her name? Yes. I can't remember her name. She's like, yeah, I mean, I'm assuming it's the same person.
Yeah, it is. She's done it for years.
Yeah. And so my girlfriend would sit in an office with Marjorie, and it's like exactly the office you would imagine, like just all books stacked everywhere in some tiny little closet office in New York. And Brooke would sit, it was only the two of them in this room, and like they were the entire organization that presented the Edgar Awards, you know, because everybody that like votes and determines, right, and you know, all the authors and stuff are scattered throughout the country. So the Edgar Awards was just literally the two of them in this room. And then sure enough, like it came time for the actual awards, and like I had to get dressed up and help them organize the whole event, like hand out the pamphlets. And I had never heard of them before, because, you know, I was like 21 years old, right, or whatever, living in New York. And it was like, that it was one of my first forays into the literary world.
Oh, wow.
Was helping hand out pamphlets and, you know, help people find their tables at the Edgar Awards. But I remember being like, wow, this is really cool. This is like, and it introduced me to a couple authors that I still read, you know, because I met them and like, right, saw them get awards.
That's
and
why you like, have that book we were talking about before the show. So before the show started, Ryder and I were talking about the book The Bottoms by Joe Lansdale, and he didn't have any idea why he had it. And it's because it won the Edgar Award when you were still dating Brooke.
Wow.
Okay.
There you go.
So I probably met him at the.
You probably met him.
I'll buy
your
book, and then it sat on my shelf until
for 17 right years.
Now. As well as a young, dashing Todd Goldberg, I can only assume.
No, my books have never been up for the Edgar Award. I got. I was up for the Hammett, which is like the Golden Globe to the Academy Award, but not the Edgar yet. And the LA Times Book Prize, of course, but not the Edgar. The Edgar, like if I were up for the Edgar, you guys would know, because I'd tattoo it on my chest right under Thug Life.
What is the, I don't even remember, like, why are the Edgars a big deal? Because is it other authors that nominate you?
Well, just like every major book award, it's voted on by authors. So the National Book Award, for instance, it's a panel of authors and critics that vote on it. The Edgar Awards is a panel of authors that vote on it. And the Edgar Awards are the preeminent awards for the mystery, crime, and thriller genre. So they have best novel, best first novel, best paperback original, best cozy. They have the Mary Higgins Clark Award. They have, you know, they also give out Edgars for crime television and crime film for the screenwriters specifically. So it's the preeminent award given to a crime writer. So to be up for that is a big deal. My brother has, did my brother win one? I think my brother won one, and then he's been nominated a couple times for TV shows. He, I think he won it for an episode of Ellery Queen in the early 2000s, which was a show that was on A&E that Timothy Hutton started. That was an adaptation of the popular book series. But yeah, I mean, it's the big literary award for crime writers. It's very prestigious. And you know, you get a little thing on your book, a little sticker and all that. So, I mean, you know, we're right about in the time of the big book award season. The National Book Awards are now. And then they start, you know, they start rolling out, the Pulitzers will come, and then the Edgars, and then the LA Times Book Prizes, all of them, they come, you know, one after the other in the next 4 or 5 months.
All right. So a lot of screaming with joy and frustration in your house then.
Well, I didn't have a book out this year, but in normal years, yes. Yeah, in normal years. But we read book that did not win the Edgar.
This conversation actually segues well to Pale Fire.
Yes, yeah, it does.
Because it's very, you know, Pale Fire is obviously very literary focused.
Yes.
So let me try and get through.
Good luck.
How to describe Pale Fire.
Yeah, Julie and I are going to step out, and then you let us know when you
figure out what
the book is about.
I'll be back in half an hour.
So Pale Fire is a novel presented as the first edition of a 999-line poem written by the fictional John Shade. And Shade's poem is introduced with a foreword and then followed by extensive commentary written by his neighbor and fellow professor, Charles Kinboat. And the book is operated on a lot of different levels. So there's the poem itself, which is drawn from Shade's life and includes the story of his daughter's suicide. And then Kinboat's commentary, which follows the poem and begins to digress into some pretty strange directions. In one thread, we get the story of Kinboat's friendship with Shade before Shade died on the same day that he finished this poem. And then we also keep getting the story
murdered.
We know that up front. And then we keep getting the story of King Charles. Is it the second or King Charles of Zembla, which is a fictional country. And the king had to escape into exile. And Kinboat really wanted Shade to write this poem about that king.
And thought that he was.
A lot of anecdotes about that king's life. And then we also get the story of, through the notes, through the commentary still, we get the story of Gratus, who is an assassin that's dispatched from Zembla, who is trying to track down the exiled king and kill him.
Spoiler.
Well...
Hold on.
Yeah, we're
going to
give away spoilers eventually.
We can give away spoilers. The book's been out for 80 years.
Well, yeah, but I think we should walk a line a little bit because I think this book is pretty, I think we can talk about it without giving away the last 20 pages. I mean, it's really the last 20 pages that it does come together.
Let's reveal it in a weird, awkward moment because that's what this book would do.
Yes, that's correct. There would be some other illusion, and I would then say, oh, that reminds me. Yeah. The reality of Pale Fire.
Yeah.
So, let's plan on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's try and hold off on spoilers, and then we'll just let it happen when it happens, okay. And we'll let the audience know that they can stop listening if they really want to read
this. Yeah, it'll be organic.
But I want to hold up because I really want to recommend this to our listeners.
Well,
there's a lot of our listeners who are going to like this book because it's a very literary disco-y book in a lot of ways. At least I think so. I mean, because it really hit the sweet spot for me. But I'm really curious what you guys think.
Well, there's no way that they'll figure it out now.
This week is brought to you by Hingston & Olsen, the publisher of the 2019 short story Advent Calendar. Remember Advent calendars? Remember the thrill of opening a new gift every morning? And the surprise of never knowing exactly what was inside? Well, now you can rediscover that joy as an adult, and with a new literary twist, thanks to Hingston & Olsen. They're the makers of the short story Advent Calendar, a deluxe box set of 25 individually bound short stories that readers open, one by one, on the mornings leading up to Christmas. Each story is sealed, so you won't know what's inside until the morning you open it. When you're done reading, visit shortstoryadventcalendar.com for an exclusive interview with the author of that day's story. These are literary, non-religious short stories for adults, and they come from some of the best writers in North America and beyond. The 2019 edition includes stories from Pulitzer Prize winner Anthony Doerr, Omar El-Akkad, Lauren Groff, Jack Pendarvis, Casey Plett, and many more. Don't wait until December 1st. Order your copy today from shortstoryadventcalendar.com and enter the promo code LITERARYDISCO at checkout to get 10% off your purchase.
All right, who wants to talk about this first?
I'll go. Todd's in a reverie of giggles. Oh boy, wow. Okay, so this book would have been like my favorite book like 20 years ago. So that was like a really nice experience being like, when's the last time I read some weirdly structured yet exquisitely written book? And yeah, the structure of it, where to start? Okay, let's just start with the writing. Let's get that out of the way before we go down the real rabbit holes here. So, I mean, this is something that was like said at Bennington a lot. I'm sure we've said it at the show. But there's like perfect sentence level writers like Amy Hempel. And then there's like perfect paragraph writers like Philip Lopate and other essayists. And Nabokov is the perfect like word writer. I don't know where the fuck he finds these words from thin air, but they are so amazing and beautiful that it's just like a pleasure to read every individual sentence, even if you currently have no idea what's happening.
And who knew he was a poet? Did you guys know he was a poet?
I knew that he was kind of all over the place. I've read Lolita and Speak Memory, before and loved it. And I mean, not only that, he's multilingual, he's a translator. Right. Like, this is his life, his world. So it didn't surprise me at all that he would just knock into some poetry. Okay, so this sentence way at the beginning, line 22. So he's like describing very early on this poet character, Shade. And he's told us he's a poet, but then he writes, he consulted his rich wristwatch. A snowflake settled upon it. Crystal to crystal, said Shade. That is like the most beautiful way to, like, first of all, who would ever have that thought? Second of all, he's putting that thought in a character that is correct. You know, he's a poet. This is a man who would have a wristwatch in the snow and then have this poetic thought and speak it so purely. So, like, that level of writing is just, it's just pleasant to experience, especially yeah, going he's one through of the this meta form.
He's one of those writers that I love because I am constantly looking up words while I'm reading. And, like, I'm not because I have to necessarily, but because I want to.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, there's obviously words I don't know, but there are words that I think I kind of know, but because they're so strangely used in this context, I'm like, I gotta look that up. And I enjoy the process. Like, every couple of pages, I'm like, what? You use that word? What does that even mean?
Did you look
and then I look it up and I'm like, it's perfect.
Commentary?
It's perfect.
Did you notice that the commentary itself, like, starts doing that at certain points?
Yes.
It's
yeah, so the comment, and then the index, which defines yeah. things, is not just an index. It's an index written by Kinboat.
Right.
Which is crazy.
There's so many levels to this book. Yeah.
What'd you think, Todd?
You know, the interesting thing for me at this moment is that I am reading 20 graduate theses at the same time that I was reading this. So I've read about 2,000 pages in the last, I don't know, 10 days, 2 weeks, something like that. And, you know, the thing about MFA students is they always think that they are discovering a new form. Like, I'm going to do something that's never been done before. Like, hey, you know what? Nabokov wrote Pale Fire, and I'd never seen anything like it before. And he did it in 1950, whatever. And 62. And then I realized after reading it, oh, so In the Lake of the Woods by Tim O'Brien is Pale Fire. And House of Leaves by Mark Danislewski is Pale Fire. And all these other meta-fiction
everything
books.
David Foster Wallace.
Everything David Foster Wallace did is Pale Fire.
Is Pale Fire.
The internet is Pale Fire.
The internet is Pale Fire.
Twitter
like
is
this
Pale
is
Fire.
Like if you could spend, and I'm sure that there's millions and millions of academic papers on this, you could spend years going back and forth through the cross references to find out the deeper meanings of every single thing in this book, because everything has dual meaning in it. And it's meticulous and it's well wrought. The fascinating thing for me, though, too, is, I mean, aside from the obvious that, you know, Nabokov is a gift to the language, you know, there's maybe not a finer writer in the history of the world, but save four or five others, right? Wow. So reading him is always an education. But he is able to get away with things that in modern literature, even in a book of this form, people wouldn't necessarily get away with, which is hundreds of pages of scene-free narrative.
Yeah.
You know, so so in the middle of the book, there is this story of King Charles of Zembla and this vast political plot against him, and the actual political and royal machinations of this. Basically, it's a Russian kingdom. And it's just a straight narrative history that the fake author, Kinboat, is also providing authorial intrusion into. And so you'll be reading something and you might feel like it's some dry recitation of fact about, you know, the different lives of people that didn't really exist. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh, actually, I'm being profoundly fucked with by the narrator of this book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you skim a single line, you will lose, I don't know, hours of reading time within it. You know, there's totally. So much in it. It's a book you have to read extraordinarily carefully. It's not a pool book. It's a book like you have to read it like 25 pages at a time. It's also super dense. But it's also really funny, incredibly dark. It is the one of the best unreliable narrators I've ever read. And it hinges on things that I love, which is the dark obsession that you are the focus of someone else's art. Yeah, I thought it was remarkable, and I was stunned and surprised I hadn't read it yet. We had it on our shelves, in fact, because Wendy, my wife, had read it when all of us were at graduate school, because she read it to write a critical paper on unreliable narrators. And so it was also fun for me to see what she'd underlined in here. Mm. And then about midway through, I was like, there's no fucking way you read this. She's like, I read it. Quiz me. So I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah, no, I fucking loved it. I think it's. I mean, I really feel like I am totally the target audience, as I think we all three probably are. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think our listeners probably are too. Like it's really it's a book about literature, yes, about reading and about writing and about how we live our lives around reading and writing and telling stories and how we share those stories and how life intrudes into text and text intrudes into life. And it is so funny and weird. I think, you know, like there were definitely times where I think I skimmed and got lost, mm-hmm, and got really frustrated. And, you know, I think it gets right to the breaking point of like the sort of, you know, I think it's called the mimetic fallacy, where it's like, if you want your audience to like, I started to be confused and annoyed in a way that I obviously was meant to be annoyed, but like, I wanted to enjoy being annoyed a little bit more. So there were times where it was just like, this is going, so basically it was a little too long at times. It was like, mm-hmm, confusing and long. And I was like, is this worth it? Like, cause I'm still reading just a note to a poem. Do I need to go back to the poem? And, you know, it was like, I just didn't know how much homework I needed to be doing, for, you know, and how absurdist it was getting. And it does take work. It takes, you just kind of have to be, you have to like be on as a reader. You cannot, yes, let your guard down. And I let my guard down at times because I was like, I get the conceit. I think it's funny. This is great. I'll just bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. And then I realized like I had just gotten through like three footnotes that actually describe shit that's going to come back and that I really kind of needed to know. And I, right, wasn't keeping track because it's dense reading. It's dense writing. It's like, yeah, it's so layered. By the end, it really brought me to an amazing place. Like, you know, when I finished it, I was like, oh my God, this is even more, it sort of wraps it up in a bow that takes it. Cause the, you know, the initial, what you realize initially is that there's a sort of insane narrator who is writing
absolutely crazy,
yes, this forward and then these comments on a pretty cool, good, fun to read poem.
Which rhymes. That, and which I was rhymes. Stunned to find that I enjoyed.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it too, man. You know, like I really, it's iambic. It's super, mm-hmm, like, it's super just pleasurable to read. It's well written.
The canto about his daughter's suicide.
So good.
Absolutely heartbreaking. Absolutely, yeah, heartbreaking.
It reminded me of Gabriel. You know, it's, yeah, one of those poems where it was like, God, oh, this is a great use of poetry to like have this, you know, parent relationship, this tragic parent story and its narrative. And I was totally on board. And, you know, I at first started reading the poem and then thinking I needed to go back and read the notes and then flip back to the poem.
Right.
Yeah.
And luckily I had a friend who had recommended this book to me and I was texting him, our good friend, John Flynn York, who,
oh, mentioned, yeah, multiple times.
And I was like, John, should I be reading the notes while I'm reading the poetry? And he's like, I did, but you probably shouldn't. Maybe read it all the way through. And I'm glad he told me. So I read the poem all the way through, which is much more fun and easier. Mm-hmm. And then once you get to the notes, you can kind of go back to the, but you almost don't have to. Yeah. At least I didn't end up going back to, because once you realize that the narrator is insane and that they're, you know, the joke or the conceit of the book, what you realize when you get to the comments is that this scholar, this critic writing about this poem is clearly making the poem about his own issues, yeah, and is clearly deciding to make this poem about something that the poet did not intend, which, right, is just awesome. Like that's the conceit of it, right? That's like the basic idea. And that is so cool. And for me, that was perfectly sustainable for about 100 pages. And then like at about 150 or so, I was like, really? Where's this? Why do I need all these extra stories? And then, damn it, you know, he brought it back.
So
like, it all kind of came around.
That's so interesting. Okay, so this is how this is different than a David Foster Wallace experience, because I did the opposite writer. I was like, I'm going to just read this straight through as if I were reading a novel, because I know that this poem's pretty short and probably the real work is contained in a straight read through of the last two thirds.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing that. And then I was like, wait a second, like, he's having fun. I'm going to have fun. And so then what I did, so I read like probably half the narrative part. And then I was like, I'm going to go back to my favorite parts of the poem and like, pretend I was basically like completely buying into the like world that is creating, that I am someone who's interested in this poet.
Right.
And then I started jumping to the sections, like really reading them as if I were like studying this work of poetry. And it was really fun. Like, it was really fun to be like, this part of the canto was boring. Canto 2 was boring. Let me go to this daughter one, which I loved, and like dig in deeper here. So it was really a fun way to read around. And I read a little on the internet about this book. And like, there's been a lot of like theses written by graduate students about like how it predicts hyperlinking, which I just like love thinking about.
Yeah.
Hold
on. Breaking news. Susan Choi's Trust Exercise, winner of the National Book Award.
Good, great not work, Susan.
Not my friend Layla. So we're now turning this off.
Okay. Well,
rot!
I'm sure Susan is great.
I'm sure Susan Choi is wonderful. Fuckers.
So yeah, anyway, hyper, like the way that we read on the internet or the way that we read through Twitter or whatever, like this is, you can read this book a lot of different ways. And that is very exciting.
Well, I don't think it predicts the internet, but it absolutely reinforces a thing that, and I think this is in fact intentional, it reinforces the thing that Shakespeare did, which is that to understand individual things, you have to understand something that is not in the text a lot of times.
Right.
And so this book talks a lot about Shakespeare. Pale Fire is taken apparently from Shakespeare, though I should probably look that up if it actually is from Shakespeare.
It is,
It is, okay. Yeah. And so there's this sort of circular nature of information that goes around. But at the end, of course, it's like the internet in the easiest way, where a person views this vast, unknowable thing and believes it's about them.
Right.
But I love the interconnectivity of all of this, and the absurdity is great. And this critic is, or this, you know, essentially biographer who's writing this commentary of this poem, who wanted it to be essentially about the life of this king of Zembla, who may or may not have some relation to him. I guess we won't know about that for another 20 minutes.
yeah, let's hold on.
Okay, we'll hold off on that. Is that, you know, he also is breaking all the rules of literary criticism by making everything that he is taking from this poem to be a thing that he is interested in and not about the text itself. Which, like, that's the opposite of what you're supposed to do as a critic. You're supposed to evaluate what is on the page, you know, as the thing that's on the page. But he's like, well, I expected this to be about Zembla, and I don't know if his daughter was this or that, but this is what I feel about my inspiration on him. All this other stuff where it's like, oh, Jesus, this is a sociopathic narcissist who's taken over the life and letters of this fantastic poet.
So,
but there's also this weird undercurrent of academia in this that I really appreciate. Yep. I love an academic novel because academics, as a faux academic, though a full professor, I should note, as a faux academic, like, I'm always in these situations where these people talking about the interscene, interdepartmental battles about shit, and it's so important to them, and I just think, you have nothing else happening in your life.
Yeah.
Can I just jump in? There, that reminds me. So we haven't talked about the foreword at all, and it's really good.
Right.
And it's just basically a bunch of academics like standing around talking about nothing. But Kimbo is a he's a vegetarian, and being Ryder, yeah. I'm sure you were dying, but like being married to a vegetarian, like this description of people talking to a vegetarian, it just killed me. Okay. My free and simple demeanor set everybody at ease. The usual questions were fired at me about eggnogs and milkshakes being or not being acceptable to one of my persuasion. Shade said that with him, it was the other way around. He must make a definite effort to partake of a vegetable. Beginning a salad was to him like stepping into a seawater on a chilly day, and he always had to brace himself in order to attack the fortress of an apple.
Oh, God. That line about my simple and kind demeanor, like that was the point at which I was like, okay, so this is in fact a crazy person.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dude, you didn't get it on the first page. Well, I thought on the first page when he's like, he's just trying to do like a very academic introduction, and he's describing like what the poem is and who the author is, and it's like the third paragraph. He's talking about his final adjustments, but with this or that corrected draft or his first fair copy. I mean, he preserved the date of actual creation rather than that of the second or third thoughts. There is a very loud amusement park right in front of my present lodgings, and you're like, what? And then like he doesn't mention it again. Like 2 pages later, he's describing something else. He's talking about forming together with the shorter flanks, twin wings of 500 verses each, and damn that music. And you're just like, oh, this person is, you know, the intrusion of the real world that this person is trying to write this academic, you know, scholarly article. I was like, immediately, I was so on board. I'm like, oh, this is, and that's what he does. Nabokov does that so well. Like his control of voice and like tone, it's insane. Like, I don't think there's, yeah, like you're saying, there's only like five people that have ever lived that have achieved this level of control.
And it actually seems like he was having fun, you know?
Yes,
like,
it's hysterical.
When you read Lolita, that doesn't necessarily feel like fun, but this is like, I'm going to write about all the things I'm really interested in, and I'm going to skewer them, but also at the same time, I'm going to ask profound questions about the nature of what it is to be a human.
So let me jump in with a footnote that I really loved. So occasionally the commentary, it's mostly story, which is great, but occasionally it is real footnotes and commentary, but it's like off. And I really love this one. So line 426. All right. Okay. So it says the reference is, of course, to Robert Frost, born 1874. Mm-hmm. And then he like talks about it for a second. Then he says, Frost is the author of one of the greatest short poems in the English language, a poem that every American boy knows by heart, about the wintry woods and the dreary dusk and the little horse bells of gentle remonstration in the dull darkening air, and that prodigious and poignant end. Two closing lines identical in every syllable, but one personal and physical, and the other metaphysical and universal. I dare not quote from memory, lest I displace one small precious word. So he like doesn't do the reference. It's so funny. It's like he's saying, it's like this guy is freehand writing these footnotes and this index. It's so funny.
There's also quite a bit. So in the poem, there's a little bit about TV essentially replacing your own thoughts. And it's really sort of prescient for what would come. And I mean, at the time, there were like three channels, and one of them was snow. So I found that really interesting. One thing that we haven't really talked about is there's this undercurrent of homosexuality in the narrator that's never addressed directly, but it also seems to be part of the rage that he is encapsulated by.
Well, yeah, well, it builds perfectly, too, because you're like, what are these references adding up to? And then you realize that, like, the shitty breakup he had with, like, his roommate probably had something to do with that. And, like, you start piecing it together. You're like, oh, right. And, you know, potentially that he's in love with Shade because he's such, he's stalking the guy. Like, that's what I love. It's like, pretty quickly you learn that he was, like, a neighbor, and he calls himself, like, Shade's best friend who, you know, he got the rights to the poem. And then you were like slowly realizing like, oh, this guy moved next to Shade and stalked him because he was obsessed with his writing. And I love that idea. I mean, again, like the way that the critic who's obsessed with the work of an author, is sort of like a stalker, you know, like even if they don't know them in real life, like the very act of inserting yourself as the only authority who can like really interpret the meaning of a poem, for instance,
right.
And like the taking the stand that like I'm going to write the definitive interpretation of this work in my footnotes, like it is kind of like being a stalkerly neighbor to the author, right? Yeah. Like that I love that relationship, like the way that Nabokov is able to make a story out of a literary process, like the process of reading and the process of being a critic, and sort of highlight the weirdness of that and like the intimacy of it and the way that you do kind of invade somebody's life when you read their work and their intimate thoughts and they're expressing themselves and then you kind of want an ownership over that and you want an authority if you're a critic or even if you're a reader, you know, you bring your own baggage and you bring your own things and interpretations and like you're putting just as much into the text often as you are taking out of it. So I just loved that, you know, as a basic conceit of this structure, like that's built into it, and then that he makes that so funny and entertaining and tragic. It's brilliant satire. It's satire of like the literary process, right. Basically. I mean Foster Wallace like comes close to this in theory, but I don't feel like he ever achieves this level of entertainment and actual storytelling. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like
I think in his essays he does.
Maybe his essays are amazing.
Less
yes,
so
but
in his fiction.
But in his fiction, yeah, I guess it's the, it's like, it's one thing to be like super clever and intelligent and deconstructive in your approach to literature. It's another thing to pull it all together the way that this book does.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, it actually does become a pretty straightforward narrative plot story yeah. with basic characters by the end. And the fact that it arrives there blew my mind. Like yes. when I, because yeah. I really thought it was just going to be this digressive deconstruction of literature and ha ha ha. And then the fact that it like, it actually arrived somewhere even weirder than that and tied it all together. And it is a novel. Like yeah. you can't it's call this sure anything other than a yeah. novel. That's genius.
You know what?
I mean, that is genius.
Did any of you go and look at the criticism of it when it came out? I didn't. I'm sort of curious, like, what was the New York Times saying about Pale Fire?
Well, I did.
I mean,
go ahead, Ryan.
Julia. I just did a little, you know, Wikipedia and Googling and stuff, and it was mixed. It was definitely mixed. Yeah. But people have obsessive pet theories about this book, which
oh,
I find
I'm sure.
fascinating.
Yes.
'Cause, and a couple of them, I was like, oh, that's actually a really good theory, which we can get into if we want to move into spoiler land. But there are a couple like really like apparently there's a lot written about this book. Mm-hmm. This is like a favorite book for people to write essays about or to have opinions on or theories about.
Because it's just another layer. How fun is that? Yeah, like you're right. participating exactly. in the book by having a theory. Go on. Sorry yep. to interrupt.
No. And apparently Nabokov himself confirmed one of the theories. Like if you look on Wikipedia, like there's one of the outlandish theories. He's like, yeah. And he's like given extra information about the story, which we can get into, but I don't know if
just
we're
like
ready to spoiler
it.
So I'm going to read the last paragraph of the New York Times review of Pale Fire, so which should reveal everything we need to know. Pale Fire is a curiosity into which it is agreeable to dip rather than a book which can be read straight through with pleasure. Hmm. Huh. Nothing can obliterate the fact that Mr. Nabokov has a keen intelligence, a restless and inquisitive mind, and a very personal style that constantly defeats his pretense of being a mere Kimboat. So this is interesting. Uh-huh. You know, this is like, oh, he's equating the author with the character. It is refreshing, too, that he has made no attempt to repeat any of the patterns that have brought him success in the past. Much of the detail in this book can be paralleled in earlier novels. For instance, his account of Professor Hurley, who is set up as an inadequate first biographer of John Shade, is very much the same as his account of Mr. Goodman, the inadequate first biographer of Sebastian Knight. But Pale Fire sets a course all its own. It is one more proof of Mr. Nabokov's rare vitality. Unluckily, it is not much more than that. Hmm. You know what the other weird thing, just to say, how weird is it is like the there were people that lived in the time when Nabokov was alive and were reviewing his books.
Yeah.
I mean, like
it's pretty recent.
That seems weird. Yeah, it's like 60 years ago. He also says, it's not a bad poem, the reviewer says.
I'd agree with that. I think in a second we should move into, like, we should have a wall coming down between non-spoiler and spoiler, because we gotta.
Yeah, okay.
But I think, you know, like, the David Foster Wallace comparisons are interesting, and the difference to me is that David Foster Wallace, like, he's nakedly, like, ambitious and, like, I'm doing something huge. And Nabokov is pulling off something really huge while looking like he's just fucking around. Like, that's cool. That's really cool. And of course, I'm sure it's a humongous, crazy amount of work. But it seems like he's like, I agree with that review, and that it's like, oh yeah, I did a perfect, you know, road trip novel. I did a perfect, you know, memoir. Okay, here's this postmodern thing. How about this? And they're all equally good. That's insane. It's creepy.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, listeners, if you do not want to know the dark truth behind Pale Fire, now's the time to stop listening. Go listen to Reply All by Gimlet Media. There's a good episode about finding a guy who leaves funny reviews of stores in Santa Fe. And in every picture, he puts a spaceship. They find him on the current episode of Reply All.
Wow.
Great.
Way to promote another podcast.
I listened to it last night. It was very
Let's see if Reply All will promote
I couldn't
us
sleep.
Response.
It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was like, oh, listen to Reply All. I believe
all
it's
right,
episode
so
156.
Post-spoiler discussion. We are in spoiler land. And it turns out that our unreliable narrator is Kinboat, is actually the exiled king of Zembla.
So wait.
And the assassin Gradus, who is tracking him down, catches up with him right out front of John Shade's house with John Shade, and accidentally shoots John Shade.
Because he's the terrible assassin. A bungling assassin.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so that is how Shade died. And because Shade's wife thought that Kinboat had stepped in front of the bullet or tried to stop the bullet, she gave him the rights to publish this poem, and this whole novel is, or this whole writing the commentary on the poetry is an opportunity for our narrator to explain himself and tell his story. So it finally, it actually kind of makes sense of all of the meta stuff that's been going on, which is just incredible. And I thought funny and wrapped it all up in a really, really nice way that made it more than just a clever exercise.
Well, so, you had to know early on that Kinboat was King Charles.
Yeah.
I was pretty slow.
Wow.
Roger Strong, not a fast learner.
Really slow.
I figured it out pretty, I don't know, maybe 150 pages in.
So here
because
we go.
Otherwise, there's not a reason to tell the story.
Yeah, I was super late.
So this is where it gets really interesting and weird, right? So, like, if I put on my Skidmore College English major hat, the evidence is quite early, very, very early. But I put big fat stars around page 122. So we're in the history, but now it's getting really personal. Like, there's no possible way for anyone to know. So the king sighed and began to undress. His camp bed and a bed table had been placed facing the window in the northeast corner. And it just goes on and on like that. Like, it's clearly in scene, like, so deep in scene. So where I get fucked up is I'm confident. I'm like, he's the king. Great. And there's a lot of really, if you do know this, if you do pick up on this, and Ryder, you should go back, like, all of these passages about, like, jumping out of planes and disguises, like, they all become more fun and rich when you realize he's, like, very strangely talking about himself. But there's that same close reading with the assassin. So what's going on there? You know, like, are these stories invented? Are there multiple personalities going on? Yep. Is this
all made up?
You know,
that's like one of the leading theories that I totally buy, because there's that weird Botkin character.
Yep.
who's like going, the Russian guy who's going crazy, the other professor is going crazy. And it's, I think the idea is that he wrote this entire thing, that he invented Zembla, invented all of these characters because he murdered Shade or...
Well, but we know that there's a guy that's... Oh, so you're saying that even the story that we're reading is someone else's story, that someone else has written this story.
That right, there's that another
Botkin layer. Is right. That there's another guy who was at the, you know, in school. Because like, you remember, you hear those references to him going insane and like saying weird things. There's like three or four like very clear references to this colleague of theirs who went insane. Right. And I mean, his name is close enough. It's like all there's all these reasons to believe. I don't know. That was one of the theories online. The one I saw, I was like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. Like. It's actually about a guy just going insane and being obsessed with John Shade and having shot him and then trying to rationalize it or explain it away or tell a whole story around it.
I go by a theory that I first learned about in the movie Contact, which is Occam's Razor.
Yeah.
Where it's like the most likely thing is not that. The most likely thing is this obsessed guy who... is trying to justify his own madness has written this thing, because the level of specificity about himself as it relates to these things, like, I mean, it's such a suspension of disbelief that you would have as a writer, like to create that as a writer, to be like, okay, what I really want is for readers to think a third person has written this entire book about these entire things that is not me also. Like, that's, it just seems like Nabokov might have been like a smart, interesting dude, but was he thinking, like, was he playing nine-dimensional chess as he wrote? No, maybe he was. I don't know.
Of anybody.
I think he kind of wanted it to be, he wanted it to allow for that possibility. Like, whether right. he, you know, I think it's maybe in the writing of it, he was like, oh, I should do this and just sort of introduce the idea of insanity and this other character, and then I might as well make it so that there's a reading of this whole book that it's inside the mind of that character. You know, I mean, I think that there's, I definitely think he was playing with as many different things as possible. Like, right. The same way that James Joyce does that shit, you know? It's like, these are such genius writers who can do whatever they want, and at a certain point, they start doing whatever they want and leaving enough open for, you know, readers to add to. I mean, he obviously likes the idea that readers add to the book that they're reading.
Right.
I mean, that is encoded within the book itself.
Right.
So the act that people, the fact that he would leave trapdoors and little jokes and in references to make you want to reread the book and add in your own interpretation is totally on point. Like, that is actually the very point of this book. So I think he did. Like, I guess apparently he said publicly, like, oh, the narrator committed suicide after that. And
when you think about it, there, afterwards.
But when you think about it, remember the whole suicide passage
that
is so random, that is so good. It's like one of the best parts of the book when he's writing about the power of suicide and when to do it and how to do it. And I remember being like, this is really weird. This feels really like this dark. Is inserted for a reason. And it's really well written and cool. And so it's like, oh, right. Like, so I don't know. I think he's just one of those genius writers who was trying to do it all.
This is the danger, right, of asking someone what really happens at the end. It's like why David Chase has been so smart not to say what happens at the end of The Sopranos. Like, hey, man, if I tell you, it devalues everything that's come before it. The joy of reading this is the not knowing, you know? Mm-hmm. It's this thing that we're doing right now for an hour after day of watching American democracy crumble in front of our very eyes. if you guys watch TV today, I do.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
I watch TV. I read, I check obsessively on the, I mean, I'm definitely in the like, oh, New York Times, Washington Post, like every hour I need to like,
yeah, it's just a sick
delete
addiction.
Them from my phone. Cause it doesn't help.
but like this thing, like to have Nabokov be like, oh yeah, he kills himself at the end. Like, no. After you write this thing, you don't get to tell us what the dot, dot, dot is. That belongs to us now.
Yeah. And it's so funny. I think I said this recently on the podcast, but it's like, we get so into it as readers, we forget, like, there's no answer. These people aren't real.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not, he can say whatever he wants, but it's not part of the text. Like, I'm one of those readers. I'm like, the text is text, and
right.
You know, it exists in the real world only as like an imaginative idea. And how cool is that? So like, there is no what really happened. And I brought up Harry Potter before because J.K. Rowling's always doing this. And it's like, people act like there's an actual alternate universe where like Harry Potter is doing something and pissed at J.K. Rowling that she won't tell us what he's doing. not what literature is or is for. Like, we're not in a multiverse. I don't know.
Yeah, and you're not nine. Like, you understand when the book is over with that the picture in your mind stops.
But I agree with you, Todd, that like, you know, I love that Sopranos ending. I love anything that has this strange open feel to it at the end, which is actually why I love creative nonfiction, is because it's very aggressive on these points, you know. Mm-hmm. Like fiction, you can be like, it's all fictional, like I just did. But creative nonfiction puts that same open air into real events, which I just love. So people need to get cool with subtlety.
Do you guys remember that first, did you guys read the first Tana French novel?
Yeah.
Into the Woods?
Yeah.
Yeah, where they don't solve the crime at the end of the book.
Yeah.
And, like, at first I was super frustrated, and then I was like, but that's actually what happens.
Yep.
A lot of times, is they don't solve the crime. And it became satisfying in a different kind of way. Like, the real world is messy and doesn't come with a bow at the end of it. And so I appreciate that in that book. And then this book, I appreciate the not knowing the full story of anything, because it is also such a broad satire of the entire, I mean, it's actually not a satire, it's a parody. And I think in the goal of parody is to make you question the things that you find intellectually stimulating a lot of times. And so this book is mocking us for being, people with advanced degrees in literature and who read books and spend a lot of time talking about them. Nabokov is like, you as a punk, Ryder Strong. You as a punk, Anna Klumsky. You as a punk, Ray Romano.
But he still manages, yeah, he is, but he still manages to be kind of romantic about writing and to make you love. There's this, I mean, I think my favorite passage is near the end of the book, right when he's when he finally gets the poem physically from Shade, and he's carrying it, and they're walking back to the house, and we know that Shade is about to die, and he has this passage about reading and imagining, or just recognizing the power of the written word. We are absurdly accustomed to the miracle of a few written signs being able to contain immortal imagery, involutions of thought, new worlds with live people speaking, weeping, laughing. We take it for granted so simply that, in a sense, by the very act of brutish routine acceptance, we undo the work of the ages, the history of the gradual elaboration of poetical description and construction from the Treeman to Browning, from the caveman to Keats. That just like I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, you just brought it home, man. Like, yes, because that's what this whole book has done. Like, it's like made me realize how crazy reading and writing is, and made me appreciate all that again, even though I've been doing it my entire life, obsessing over it, writing, you know, writing myself, reading myself, making a podcast about those things. Like, so to have a book like just smack me in the face with that really basic idea, to just be like, writing is powerful. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, you know, it's like, it's so powerful and it's so beautiful. And it's like, it's like what I live for, you know, it's just one of those things. Yeah. And
it turns out Vlad was pretty good.
I had only read Lolita before this.
I've only ever read Lolita 2 and some of
his
essays.
I'm going to read everything. I'm like, all right, that's it. Like, I got to, you know, I got to read everything.
So he studied French and Russian literature. That seems good. Lived in Berlin and Paris.
Wrote in English.
Wrote in English. Lived in Montreal, then lived in Switzerland until he died in 1977. We were alive, or I was alive when he died. I didn't, like, no one even told me. No one called.
I missed him by 2 years.
He died the same year Elvis did. What does that mean? I don't know if it's connected. Probably not.
Maybe they're both just in your mind, Todd.
He also died the same year my mom got like her third divorce. So there we go.
Way to make it about you.
Into the literature, man.
All ties together.
Literary Disco is produced and edited by Justin Alvarez for Lit Hub Radio. You can reach out to us directly on Twitter @LiteraryDisco. Happy reading, everybody. Thanks for listening.